Welcome to the History Maps podcast. So think about a massive, modern, multinational corporation, maybe a global logistics giant or a major tech conglomerate.
Right.
Now, picture that same corporation suddenly holding a press conference to announce that it has built its own navy.
Yeah, quite the image.
Right. And they announce they are hiring their own private standing army. They are actively invading sovereign nations to secure an absolute monopoly on a specific critical resource. And to top it all off, the government has just handed them the full legal mandate to wage offensive war just to protect their quarterly profits.
It sounds like the setup for a dystopian science fiction novel, honestly.
It really does. But we are actually looking at a documented historical reality today. In this deep dive, we are examining the Dutch colonial empire.
And it is a structure that, well, it completely defies the traditional template of imperial expansion. I mean, when you analyze empires throughout history, whether you were looking at the Romans, the Spanish, or the Portuguese, the primary objective is almost always contiguous territorial conquests.
Right, moving borders outward.
Exactly. It is about moving armies across borders, claiming these vast tracts of inland territory, and directly subjugating the populations within those borders to a central monarch. But the Dutch model operated on an entirely different set of mechanics. We are looking at a global network spanning from 1595 all the way to 1975, and it was fundamentally rooted in maritime supremacy and corporate enterprise.
And that is the core paradox we really need to unpack for you today. Because we are talking about a relatively tiny, largely waterlogged republic in northwestern Europe. Yet they somehow projected this intense power across the Americas, Africa, and Asia simultaneously. And they didn't do this by, planting flags and marching vast armies across entire continents.
No, they did it by treating the entire globe as a massive balance sheet. The
Exactly.
Dutch expansion was, at its very core, a business venture. The objective was never to govern massive inland populations.
Because governing people is expensive.
Highly expensive. You have to provide infrastructure, administration, defense. The Dutch objective was the absolute control of international shipping routes, very specific coastal choke points, and global trade monopolies.
So our mission for this deep dive is to examine the specific mechanisms detailed in our sources that allowed this small republic to build an empire that wrapped entirely around the globe. We really want to understand the economic logic, the naval strategy, and the cultural mechanics that sustained this whole operation.
And crucially, we need to look at how these mechanisms generated unprecedented wealth for a select few, while systematically inflicting profound, often devastating consequences on millions of others across multiple continents.
Right. So, to understand how and why the Dutch built this massive global corporate apparatus, we have to start by looking at the pressures that forged it. I mean, nations do not typically venture out into the dangerous, totally unknown expanses of the global ocean just out of sheer curiosity.
No, absolutely not. There has to be a catalyst. The Dutch were propelled outward by an existential crisis occurring directly on their own soil. We really must begin with the 80 Years' War.
So, if we go back to the 1560s, the Dutch provinces are locked in this massive, brutal rebellion against the Spanish Empire.
Right.
And the Spanish Empire at this time is the preeminent global superpower. So the Dutch are fighting for their political and religious survival.
And this rebellion, it is the crucible of the Dutch state. It ultimately leads to the creation of the de facto independent Dutch Republic by 1588. But the mechanics of this war, and specifically the human cost, are vital to understand before we look at their expansion. The historical documentation estimates between 600,000 and 700,000 victims during this conflict.
Which is a staggering number for that era.
It is. And what is most critical is that up to 400,000 of those casualties were civilians.
400,000 civilian deaths in a relatively small geographic area is a demographic catastrophe. And a massive portion of those deaths were not from direct battlefield combat, right?
No, they were from the secondary mechanics of warfare, specifically disease and intentional starvation during prolonged sieges. The Spanish armies would encircle Dutch cities, cut off the food supply, and simply wait.
Just a total war of attrition.
Exactly. It was a war of absolute attrition, and wars of attrition require an immense amount of capital to sustain. The Dutch needed a constant, massive influx of wealth just to fund their armies, build their fortifications, and keep their fledgling state afloat.
But right in the middle of all this devastation, a major geopolitical event occurs that threatens to cut off their primary source of wealth. In 1580, we see the formation of the Iberian Union.
Yes. The crowns of Spain and Portugal are joined under the rule of Philip II of Spain.
And you might wonder why a political merger on the Iberian Peninsula matters to merchants up in the Dutch provinces.
It matters entirely because of the mechanics of the spice trade. Prior to 1580, the port of Lisbon in Portugal was the primary European terminal for spices coming from Asia. The Portuguese sailed to India and Indonesia, brought the goods back to Lisbon, and stopped.
They didn't distribute them.
Right. The Dutch had built a highly lucrative economy acting as the middlemen. Dutch ships would sail down to Lisbon, purchase the spices in bulk, and then distribute them throughout northern Europe, up into the Baltic Sea, and across to England.
So the entire Dutch economy relies on accessing that market in Lisbon. But when Philip II of Spain, the very monarch the Dutch are fighting a brutal war against, takes over Portugal, he immediately weaponizes that trade route.
He does. He enacts an economic blockade. The Dutch are officially banned from entering Portuguese ports.
That is the catalyst right there. It is an economic strangulation tactic. The Spanish crown calculates that if they cut off the Dutch from the spice trade, the Dutch Republic will simply run out of money and the rebellion will collapse.
It is the 17th century equivalent of a modern supply chain chokehold. If one single geopolitical rival suddenly controls every fiber optic cable in the world and just shuts off your access, your entire economy grinds to a halt.
And you only have one option left. If you are locked out of the only grocery store in town, you have to figure out how to lay your own cables, so to speak, or find the original supplier yourself, even if that supplier is located on the exact opposite side of the planet.
Right. The Dutch still desperately needed the revenue from spices to fight their war, so they were forced to bypass Lisbon entirely.
But this was no simple task, was it?
Not at all. The oceanic routes to Asia were heavily guarded state secrets. The Portuguese had spent a century mapping the winds, the currents, and the specific navigational paths required to safely reach the Indian Ocean. A Dutch merchant could not simply go out and buy a map to Indonesia.
Which brings in the element of corporate espionage.
Yes, espionage was crucial.
A Dutch merchant named Cornelis de Houtman manages to operate covertly in Lisbon and essentially acquires these classified Portuguese trade routes. He gathers the intelligence required to navigate that deeply treacherous journey around the southern tip of Africa and into the Indian Ocean basin.
And armed with this stolen navigational intelligence, the Dutch pivot rapidly. In the 1590s, we see a sudden massive explosion of maritime activity. Merchants in different Dutch cities begin forming what are called pioneer companies, or voorkompanieë.
Which were basically small independent syndicates, right?
Exactly. A group of wealthy individuals in Amsterdam or Zeeland would pool their money, outfit a few ships, hire a crew, and send them toward Brazil, West Africa, or the Indian Ocean to procure goods directly.
But the mechanics of this early strategy created a massive structural problem. We have this scattershot collection of small, disjointed pioneer companies all sailing out to the exact same locations. How could these fragmented little syndicates possibly compete with the monolithic, state-backed monopolies of the Spanish and Portuguese empires?
Well, the short answer is that they could not. The pioneer companies were actually destroying their own economic viability. Let us break down the basic supply and demand mechanics that unfolded. Because there were multiple independent Dutch companies arriving in Asia simultaneously, they found themselves bidding against each other to purchase spices from local rulers.
Oh, so they are driving up the local prices.
Exactly. This intense internal competition drove the purchase prices in Asia sky high.
And then those same Dutch ships would race back to Europe and flood the market with all those spices all at once.
Which immediately crashed the selling price back home.
So they were buying at the absolute peak and selling at the absolute bottom.
Precisely. The profit margins were completely evaporating. The entire endeavor of breaking the Iberian monopoly was on the verge of bankrupting itself through sheer internal dysfunction.
And the Dutch government looks at this chaotic situation and realizes that if these merchants keep undercutting each other, the Republic will lose its only vital source of revenue. So the state intervenes, and the solution they engineer completely rewrites global economic history. In 1602, they invent the modern joint stock company.
Yes. The States General, which is the governing body of the Dutch Republic, forces all of these squabbling pioneer companies to merge into one single massive corporation.
Yeah.
This entity is the VOC, the Dutch East India Company.
Mm.
And to ensure its success, the government grants this new corporation a 21-year absolute monopoly on all Dutch trade east of the Cape of Good Hope.
Meaning no other Dutch citizen is legally allowed to operate in that half of the world.
Right, it was total exclusivity.
We really need to dissect the financial architecture of the VOC because it is the blueprint for modern capitalism as we know it. How did a joint stock company actually function in 1602?
The structural genius of the VOC was how it capitalized risk. In the past, funding a maritime voyage required a single wealthy aristocrat or a monarch to front the entire cost.
And if the ship sank, that individual lost everything.
Exactly. Total financial ruin. But the VOC introduced the concept of tradable shares and limited liability to the general public.
Meaning that instead of one person taking all the risk, the VOC allowed anyone to buy a fraction of the venture.
Yes. The subscription was open to all residents of the Republic. You certainly had wealthy merchants investing massive sums, but you also had bakers, blacksmiths, and domestic workers investing their life savings into the company.
So they were pooling the capital of an entire nation into one corporate entity.
Right. If a ship went down, you only lost the small amount you invested. If the ship returned laden with spices, you received a dividend proportional to your shares. This created an unprecedented pool of liquid capital managed centrally in Amsterdam.
And the strategic direction of this massive pool of capital was controlled by a board of directors known as the Heer in the Seventh, or the Lord 17. 17 men sitting in a boardroom in the Netherlands, trying to manage operations occurring on the other side of the planet.
And the logistical challenge of that management structure is difficult to overstate. I mean, in the 17th century, there is no instant communication. A letter drafted by the Lord 17 detailing a shift in strategy or ordering an attack would take roughly 8 to 12 months to reach the governor general in Asia via ship.
And it would take another 8 to 12 months for the reply to come back. That means the board in Amsterdam is making executive decisions based on geopolitical intelligence that is nearly 2 years out of date.
Which is exactly why the company required something far more potent than just a trade monopoly. Because the executives in Asia could not wait for permission from Amsterdam every time a crisis arose, they needed absolute authority to act on their own. And this leads to a highly significant moment in corporate history. The resolution of November 1st, 1603.
This is the moment the paradigm completely shifts. The States General officially authorizes the VOC to build its own military forts, maintain its own standing armies, and wage defensive war.
We really must pause and analyze the implications of that resolution. A sovereign government just handed a legal mandate for warfare to a board of corporate directors whose sole legal obligation was to maximize profit for their shareholders.
But how does the state justify this? I mean, why would a government hand over the monopoly on violence to a business? Are they not worried this corporation will drag the Republic into endless, unmanageable global conflicts?
The Dutch state justified it through sheer pragmatism. The Republic was fighting a desperate war of survival against Spain at home. The government simply did not have the funds or the naval capacity to simultaneously fight the Spanish and Portuguese in Asia.
So they outsourced it.
Exactly. By granting the VOC the right to wage war, the state essentially outsourced its foreign policy and its naval combat to the private sector. The understanding was that the VOC would self-fund its military operations by systematically capturing Spanish and Portuguese wealth in Asia.
The line between a commercial enterprise and a sovereign state is completely erased at that point. The VOC is no longer just a trading company. It is a heavily armed instrument of state-sanctioned violence. They are using shareholder capital to fund military strikes and using military strikes to secure monopolies that pay dividends to the shareholders.
And that cyclical model of violence and profit was so effective that the Dutch realized they needed to replicate it for the other half of the globe. So, in 1621, the WIC, the Dutch West India Company, is established. The government grants them a 25-year monopoly, but this time covering the Atlantic, the Americas, and West Africa.
So while the VOC was focused on spices in the East, the WIC operated under a completely different strategic framework. Our sources note they utilized a strategy known explicitly as the Grand Design, and the ultimate goal of this design was to corner the international sugar trade.
And the mechanics of the sugar trade require a totally different approach than spices. Spices like nutmeg or cloves grow on trees. You just harvest them. Sugar requires massive, highly intensive agricultural plantations. It requires industrial mills to process the cane. And most crucially, it requires a staggering amount of human labor.
To execute the grand design, the WIC developed a two-pronged military strategy. First, they had to attack the Portuguese colonies in Brazil to physically seize the sugarcane plantations.
Right.
But possessing the land was useless without the labor force to work it. So simultaneously, they had to launch naval invasions against the slave ports in West Africa that supplied those plantations.
The WIC was essentially engaging in violent vertical integration. They sought to own the raw land in the Americas and to control the entire supply chain of enslaved human beings in Africa required to work that land.
But launching simultaneous transatlantic invasions requires massive capital up front. How did the WIC fund this grand design in the beginning? When you look at their early operations, it does not look like trade at all. It looks like state-sponsored piracy operating under a corporate logo.
The legal term of the era was privateering, and it was the core financial engine of the WIC in its early decades. The company funded its operations primarily by issuing letters of marque to its captains, legally authorizing them to hunt down and capture Spanish and Portuguese treasure fleets in the Caribbean and the Atlantic.
They were balancing their corporate ledgers with stolen silver. They would intercept a Spanish galleon loaded with silver from the mines in the Americas, capture it, bring the wealth back to Amsterdam, and distribute it as a massive dividend to the shareholders.
Exactly. That influx of captured capital is what allowed them to fund the armies necessary to invade Brazil later on.
So we have these two heavily militarized corporate entities, the VOC operating in the east and the WIC in the west. To understand how they wielded this power, we need to examine their operations in detail, starting with the VOC's most profitable theater, the East Indies.
And the absolute epicenter of their strategy was the Spice Islands.
Specifically, a small archipelago known as the Maluku Islands. To understand the Dutch obsession with this specific geography, you really have to understand the biological rarity of the commodities involved. In the 17th century, the Maluku Islands were the only place on the entire planet where the trees that produced cloves, nutmeg, and mace grew natively.
And these were not just flavor enhancers for food. In Europe, these spices were absolute luxury status symbols. They were used heavily in medicine and preservation. The demand was incredibly inelastic, and the supply was geographically bottlenecked to this one tiny cluster of volcanic islands in the Pacific.
Whoever controls those islands controls the entire global market.
And the VOC was determined to be the sole controller. The historical documentation regarding how they secured these islands presents a stark and brutal mechanical reality of corporate colonialism. A critical example is the conquest of the Banda Islands in 1621.
The Banda Islands were the world's exclusive source of nutmeg. The local Bandanese chiefs, known as the Orang Kaya, operated on a free trade model. They wanted to sell their nutmeg to the highest bidder, whether that was the Dutch, the English, or Japanese merchants.
Right, basic market economics.
But the VOC arrives and demands an absolute monopsony, meaning the VOC would be the only legal buyer and they would set the price arbitrarily low.
And when the Bandanese leadership repeatedly resisted these demands and attempted to maintain open trade, the VOC responded with overwhelming systematic military force. Under the direction of Governor General Jan Pieter Zoon Kon, the Dutch launched an expedition to permanently resolve the issue.
And this was not just a simple naval blockade. This was a total military subjugation. The VOC utilized their own forces, and they actively imported Japanese mercenaries, specifically masterless samurai or ronin, to execute a campaign of severe violence against the Bandanese population.
The local leadership was executed. The islands were depopulated through organized violence and forced displacement. And the VOC subsequently divided the land into structured plantations, which they handed over to former company employees to run.
And who worked those plantations?
They used enslaved labor brought in from other parts of Asia. Through sheer devastation, the VOC achieved total control of the nutmeg supply.
To manage this expanding, violent network of monopolies, the VOC needed a centralized nervous system in Asia. Sailing ships back to Europe for repairs or administrative decisions was far too inefficient. So in 1619, they established the city of Batavia, which is modern-day Jakarta.
Batavia became the administrative and logistical headquarters. It allowed the VOC to coordinate regional trade within Asia itself. They could trade Indian textiles for Indonesian spices and then sell those spices in Japan for silver, all without the ships ever having to return to Amsterdam.
It was an incredibly sophisticated intra-Asian trading network managed entirely from Batavia.
It was. But the Dutch were not the only Europeans trying to tap into this massive wealth. The English East India Company was actively trying to secure its own footholds in the region, and the VOC's mandate was to eliminate all competition, regardless of who it was. Which leads us to the Amboina Massacre in 1623.
The geopolitical context of Amboina is fascinating because back in Europe, the Dutch Republic and England were technically allies. They were united by treaties against the Catholic powers of Spain and France.
Right.
But in the East Indies, they were bitter, cutthroat corporate rivals.
The English had established a small trading post on the island of Amboina, operating right in the shadow of a massive Dutch fortress. The Dutch governor there suspected the English were conspiring with Japanese mercenaries to seize the fort.
Whether the conspiracy was real or fabricated remains a point of historical debate in the sources, but the Dutch response was absolute. The VOC authorities arrested the English merchants. They subjected them to severe torture, specifically waterboarding, to extract confessions.
And following these coerced confessions, the Dutch executed 10 Englishmen, along with 9 Japanese mercenaries and 1 Portuguese overseer.
The execution of Allied citizens by a corporate authority creates an immense diplomatic crisis. When news of the massacre finally reaches London a year later, the public outrage is explosive. It creates a deep rift between the two nations that simmers for decades.
But the long-term geopolitical fallout in Asia is what truly matters here. The incident at Amboina effectively breaks the English resolve to compete in the Indonesian archipelago. The English East India Company decides the cost of fighting the heavily entrenched VOC over spices is simply too high.
So, the English pivot. They abandon Indonesia entirely and shift their entire focus toward a different landmass, the Indian subcontinent.
Which is a massive historical irony.
Exactly. By ruthlessly driving the English out of the spice trade, the Dutch inadvertently forced the English to lay the groundwork for what will eventually become the British Raj in India, the absolute crown jewel of the British Empire.
Meanwhile, the Dutch cement their dominant hold over the East Indies. But empires, especially corporate ones, are rarely static.
Mm.
If we trace the timeline forward into the late 18th century, the fundamental structure of this presence begins to collapse.
Right.
By the year 1800, the VOC, burdened by massive debt, rampant internal corruption, and the crippling costs of endless regional wars, goes completely bankrupt.
A corporation that functioned as a state finally fails. When the VOC dissolves, the Dutch government is forced to step in and assume direct administrative control over the territories the company had acquired. The region officially becomes the Dutch East Indies.
And with direct state control comes an entirely new mechanism for economic exploitation. The shift from a maritime monopoly to direct territorial taxation is formalized in 1830 by Governor General Johannes van den Bosch. He implements a policy known as the Kulturstelsel, or the culture system.
The culture system completely restructures the agrarian reality of the Indonesian population. Under the VOC, the focus was mostly on extracting existing spices. But under the culture system, the Dutch state dictates exactly what the land itself must produce.
The mechanics of the policy were brutally simple. Indonesian farmers were legally forced to dedicate a minimum of 20% of their arable land and a significant portion of their labor to the cultivation of specific export crops demanded by the European market.
So they were not allowed to grow what they needed to feed themselves. They had to grow cash crops like coffee, sugar, indigo, and tea. This mandatory cultivation functioned as a direct form of taxation paid in raw agricultural output.
And the economic calculus for the Netherlands was substantial. By forcing millions of people to grow high-value commodities without paying them a fair market wage, the Dutch state generated a tidal wave of revenue. The profits extracted through the culture system essentially balanced the entire national budget of the Netherlands.
It funded massive modern infrastructure projects at home, including the construction of the Dutch National Railway Network, and subsidized the military.
But the mechanics of forcing an entire population to dedicate their best land and their labor to cash crops has an inevitable, devastating consequence on the ground.
Right, because you are taking land that has traditionally been used to grow rice, the staple food required for survival, and turning it into an indigo plantation, and you cannot eat indigo.
Precisely. The displacement of subsistence farming led directly to severe, widespread famine and grinding poverty across the archipelago. The indigenous farmers were trapped in a system where their labor enriched a distant European capital while their own families starved.
It is essentially like a landlord not just demanding rent, but dictating exactly what the tenant must cook for dinner, taking all the food, and leaving the tenant with nothing.
That is a very accurate comparison. And the enforcement of this system relied on a deeply coercive social structure. The Dutch did not simply send thousands of European overseers into the fields. They co-opted the existing local power structures.
They utilized the local Indonesian aristocrats and regents, tying their personal financial incentives directly to the crop yields.
Yes, these local elites were given a percentage of the output, which incentivized them to brutally enforce the quotas and extract unpaid labor from their own populations on behalf of the Dutch colonial administration.
But the social disruption and the sheer volume of human suffering generated by this system eventually triggered a massive political backlash, even within the Netherlands, right?
It did. As awareness of the famine and exploitation spread, liberal politicians heavily criticized the state's actions based on the deep ethical violations.
And this mounting pressure culminated in the gradual dismantling of the culture system, replacing it with the agrarian law in 1870, which opened the region to private enterprise rather than state-mandated forced cultivation. But the structural damage to the indigenous economy was permanent.
It was. Now, while the East Indies provided this relentless flow of spices and later cash crops, the WIC was executing its own deeply intensive strategy across the Atlantic. This theater was not about spices. It was centered entirely on sugar, territorial control, and the transatlantic trade in human lives. Let us shift our focus to New Holland, better known as Dutch Brazil.
The Dutch recognized that the Portuguese had already established the blueprint for massive sugar wealth in Brazil. To capture that wealth, the WIC invaded and seized control of the northeastern coast. The Dutch presence expanded significantly under the administration of Governor Johan Moritz, who arrived in the capital city of Recife in 1637.
Under Moritz, New Holland extends along the Brazilian coastline, from Sergipe to Maranhão. They are seizing the physical infrastructure, the sugar mills, the established plantations. But as we discussed earlier, sugar is completely dependent on a massive, continuous supply of labor to harvest and process the cane in brutal tropical conditions.
And this is where the WIC executes the second phase of their vertical integration. They could not rely on purchasing enslaved labor from their Portuguese enemies. Therefore, the WIC actively targets and captures the most crucial Portuguese slave trading fortresses on the West African coast.
The military operations in Africa are directly tied to the agricultural demands in Brazil. They capture Elmina Castle in what is now Ghana. They take the island of Gorée off the coast of Senegal. And they capture Luanda in Angola.
By controlling these specific logistical hubs, the WIC seized direct control over the supply chain of the transatlantic slave trade. They were treating human beings entirely as a mechanized corporate input required to keep the sugar factories in Brazil operating at maximum profitability.
But despite the vast amounts of capital pouring into the system, the entire operation in Brazil eventually collapses, due to a combination of corporate short-sightedness and geopolitical shifts.
The WIC board of directors in Amsterdam was obsessed with immediate quarterly profits and cost-cutting. They viewed Governor Moritz's administrative expenses and his military campaigns in Brazil as far too high, so they recalled him to Europe in 1643.
And simultaneously, the political landscape in Europe shifts again. In 1640, the Iberian Union ends. Portugal regains its independence from Spain.
And a newly independent Portugal can now focus all its resources on reclaiming its most valuable colony.
Exactly. The Portuguese colonists in Brazil, who had been chafing under Dutch Protestant rule, launch a massive rebellion. Without adequate financial or military support from the WIC directors, the Dutch position rapidly deteriorates.
The Dutch are fundamentally outmatched on the ground, and they are forced into a prolonged retreat. Ultimately, they recognize they cannot hold the territory, but they managed to turn even their surrender into a corporate transaction.
They do. In 1661, the Dutch formally abandon all claims to Brazil, but only in exchange for a massive multi-ton payout in gold from the Portuguese crown. They essentially sold the lost colony back to Portugal.
While the Brazilian venture failed, the Dutch were active further north. In North America, the Dutch had established the colony of New Netherland in 1614, primarily to secure access to the lucrative fur trade along the Hudson River.
This territory, with its capital of New Amsterdam on the island of Manhattan, became a point of intense friction with the rapidly expanding English colonies. This rivalry ignites into the Second Anglo-Dutch War.
The conflict reaches North America directly. In 1664, English naval forces sail into the harbor of New Amsterdam and demand its surrender. The Dutch governor, Peter Stuyvesant, realizes he lacks the military capacity to defend it, and the city is captured without a single shot being fired.
The legal resolution to this conflict is formalized 3 years later in 1667 with the Treaty of Breda. And the negotiations at Breda highly illuminate the absolute economic calculus that drove the Dutch Empire.
At the negotiating table, the Dutch have a distinct choice. During the war, they had successfully conquered a highly developed English sugar colony in South America called Suriname. Meanwhile, the English had captured New Netherland. The treaty essentially offers a formalized swap, and you keep what you conquered.
The Dutch actively choose to formally cede New Netherland, meaning they hand over the island of Manhattan and the future site of New York City to the English. In exchange, they demand to keep the sugar colony of Suriname.
I mean, if you look at that from a modern perspective, trading the future financial capital of the globe for a swampy enclave in South America seems like the most catastrophic real estate deal in human history.
If you judge it by modern metrics, absolutely.
Yeah.
But if you apply the economic logic of the 17th century corporate boardroom, it is the only viable choice. New Netherland was a cold, sparsely populated outpost reliant on the fur trade, which had a very limited growth ceiling.
Suriname, on the other hand, was a turnkey agricultural factory producing sugar, which was the most valuable commodity in the Atlantic world at the time.
Right. The shareholders of the WIC demanded immediate high-yield dividends. Suriname offered guaranteed substantial profits today. Manhattan offered uncertain potential decades in the future. The corporate mandate dictated that cash crop extraction vastly outweighed long-term colonial development.
To maintain this vast, fragmented global network, moving spices from Indonesia, sugar from the Caribbean, and silver from Europe required a logistical system of unprecedented scale. The sheer oceanic distances involved created immense physical challenges, and this logistical necessity brings us to the very southern tip of the African continent.
The voyage from Amsterdam to Batavia took anywhere from 8 to 10 months. You cannot put a crew on a wooden ship for 10 months without stopping. And the primary reason is biology, specifically scurvy.
Scurvy is a severe deficiency of vitamin C, right?
Exactly. The human body requires it to maintain connective tissue. On these month-long voyages, sailors survived on diets of salted meat and dried hardtack. Without fresh produce, their bodies literally began to break down. The mortality rates were staggering. A VOC ship could easily lose a third or more of its crew to scurvy before ever reaching the Indian Ocean.
From a corporate perspective, a dead crew means a ship cannot sail, which means cargo is lost, which means profits vanish. Curing scurvy was not about humanitarianism. Fresh fruit was literally a vital corporate asset required to protect their maritime investment. They desperately needed a reliable halfway point to restock supplies.
Which leads directly to the establishment of the Cape Colony. In April 1652, the VOC dispatches an official named Jan van Riebeck to establish a settlement at the Cape of Good Hope in modern-day South Africa.
The explicit mandate from the Lord 17 in Amsterdam is critical here. They did not want a sprawling colony. Colonies require infrastructure, defense, and administration, all of which cost money. The Cape was intended to be strictly a victualling station.
It was a corporate gas station and a hospital. They were ordered to build a fort, plant a massive vegetable garden, barter for cattle with the locals, supply the passing ships, and do absolutely nothing else.
The directive was purely logistical. However, the geographic and economic realities on the ground immediately challenged that mandate. The small VOC outpost struggled to produce enough food to supply both themselves and the massive fleets passing through. Importing staple foods from Europe or Asia to feed the station was financially ruinous.
So the VOC realizes their gas station is operating at a massive loss. To cut the internal costs of the company, they make a bureaucratic decision in 1657 that accidentally changes the demographic future of Southern Africa.
To increase agricultural output without paying wages, the VOC releases a small group of employees from their corporate contracts.
These individuals are designated as free burghers, or independent citizens, and they are granted tracts of land outside the immediate control of the fort to farm for themselves, with the stipulation that they must sell their produce back to the VOC at fixed prices.
This is the exact moment the corporate outpost mutates into a permanent settler colony. And granting European farmers land inherently means taking that land from someone else. The Cape was already inhabited by the indigenous Khoikhoi people.
The Khoikhoi were a complex pastoralist society. Their entire economy and culture were deeply tied to the seasonal migration of their massive cattle herds across the landscape.
When the Dutch freeburgers begin staking claims, they build fences. They enclose the water sources and the vital grazing routes. This territorial expansion directly threatens the survival of the Khoikhoi way of life.
The resulting interactions are a complex mix of necessary trade, cultural misunderstanding, and inevitable conflict. The historical record provides a profound narrative vignette regarding this dynamic, focusing on two specific Khoikhoi individuals, a man named Achumel, known to the Europeans as Harry, and his niece, Krotoa.
The story of Krotoa perfectly encapsulates the intense pressures of cultural brokerage. As a young girl, she was taken into the household of Jan van Riebeck. She was raised alongside his family, she was baptized into the Christian faith, given the Dutch name Eva, and learned to speak fluent Dutch and Portuguese.
And because of her linguistic skills, she becomes the primary interpreter between the VOC administration and the various Khoikhoi clans. She is trapped between two entirely different worlds.
The Dutch rely on her to negotiate massive cattle trades, while the Khoikhoi rely on her to protect their interests and navigate the bewildering legal demands of these newly arrived Europeans.
Her position highlights the intricate and deeply fraught reliance the early colonial administration had on indigenous intermediaries. But diplomacy and translation could not stop the mechanics of expansion. As the Dutch farmers demanded more land, the Khoikhoi leadership recognized the existential threat. This tension escalated into a violent, coordinated revolt in 1659.
The resistance is led by a Khoikhoi man named Doman. What makes Doman critical is that he was not naive to European tactics. He had actually traveled on a VOC ship to the East Indies. He had seen firsthand what the Dutch did to the populations in Indonesia when they wanted land and resources.
He understood exactly what the European expansion at the Cape would ultimately look like.
Doman led strategic raids against the Freeburgers, specifically targeting their stolen cattle and utilizing the rainy season to neutralize the Dutch matchlock muskets. The war ended in a tense stalemate, but the trajectory was set. The continuous encroachment by the settlers steadily eroded the pastoral networks.
And the final collapse of the indigenous societal structure is brought about by biology. In 1713, a devastating smallpox epidemic sweeps through the Cape, introduced by passing ships.
The Khoikhoi had no acquired immunity to the virus. The demographic devastation was near total in many areas, shattering their remaining social and economic cohesion and leaving the land entirely open to unchecked European expansion.
With the indigenous labor pool effectively destroyed and the agricultural demands of the expanding colony increasing, the Dutch required a new workforce to sustain the Cape. So they plugged the colony directly into their global maritime network. They begin importing enslaved people on a massive scale.
The demographic origins of this enslaved population were vast. The VOC brought in people from West Africa, from Madagascar, and crucially, a significant number from the East Indies and Southeast Asia, including political exiles and skilled artisans.
So the Cape rapidly develops into a highly stratified society. You have a small ruling class of Dutch VOC officials, an expanding population of independent Dutch farmers, and a massive, diverse underclass of enslaved laborers from across the Indian Ocean basin.
And then a final major demographic element is introduced into this hierarchy by geopolitics in Europe. In 1685, French Huguenots begin arriving at the Cape.
The Huguenots were French Protestants fleeing severe religious persecution after the Catholic French monarchy revoked the Edict of Nantes, which had previously granted them rights. The Dutch Republic offered them asylum and transported several hundred of them to the Cape Colony to boost the agricultural expertise, specifically in viticulture or winemaking.
But the VOC administration was deeply paranoid about internal rebellion. They did not want a unified, French-speaking enclave forming within their colony.
To prevent this, the VOC engineered a policy of forced assimilation. They deliberately dispersed the French Huguenot families on isolated farms interspersed among the existing Dutch settlers. They banned the use of the French language in schools and churches.
The strategy worked completely. Within two generations, the French language vanished. But this deliberate blending of isolated Dutch farmers, assimilated French refugees, and the deep linguistic and cultural influences of the vast enslaved population forged something entirely new. It resulted in the birth of a distinct culture and an entirely new language, heavily rooted in strict Calvinist doctrines, the Afrikaner culture.
It is a notable historical trajectory. The VOC demanded a highly controlled, tightly budgeted corporate gas station. Through a series of logistical compromises and demographic shifts, they accidentally engineered the foundation of a permanently entrenched, heavily stratified settler society with an entirely distinct cultural identity.
This relentless expansion, whether intentional in Indonesia or accidental at the Cape, combined with the sheer, unprecedented profitability of the Dutch maritime network, inevitably drew the hostile attention of other European powers.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot dominate global shipping without making powerful enemies.
No, you certainly cannot.
As we transition into the late 17th and 18th centuries, the Dutch face a prolonged era of global chess, leading to a slow but inevitable decline. And the primary architect of that decline is the rising power of the British.
The friction between the Dutch and the English shifts from localized corporate skirmishes, like Amboina, into full-scale state warfare. The conflict fundamentally ignites with a piece of legislation. The English Navigation Acts, first passed in 1651.
We have to understand the economic theory of mercantilism that drove this. The British realized they simply cannot outcompete the Dutch in open maritime logistics. Dutch ships were faster, their crews were smaller and cheaper, and their financing was better. Since the British cannot beat them in the free market, they decide to legislate them out of existence.
The Navigation Acts decreed that any goods imported into England or its extending colonies had to be carried either on an English ship or a ship from the country that actually produced the goods.
Which is a direct, calculated attack on the Dutch carrying trade. The Dutch were the middlemen of Europe. They did not produce the lumber from the Baltic or the tobacco from the Americas. They just transported it. The Navigation Acts made the core function of the Dutch economy illegal in British ports.
This aggressive economic protectionism immediately triggered a series of Anglo-Dutch wars that spanned decades. The mechanics of these wars were brutal naval engagements fought in the North Sea and the English Channel. While the Dutch held their own initially, achieving several significant victories, the long-term arithmetic was against them.
It was a war of attrition, and Britain simply had a larger population, a larger tax base, and could absorb the financial shocks of warfare better than the small Dutch Republic. The cost of continuously rebuilding fleets and fighting the British slowly but inexorably drained the Dutch treasury.
Simultaneously, the Dutch were facing major strategic losses on the other side of the globe. A prime example is the loss of their foothold in Taiwan, historically known as Formosa.
The VOC had utilized Taiwan as a crucial logistical hub for managing the highly lucrative trade involving Chinese silk and Japanese silver. But in 1661, they are confronted by a massive military force led by the Ming loyalist general Koxinga.
Koxinga was fleeing the advancing Qing dynasty on mainland China and required a secure base of operations. He targeted the Dutch presence on Taiwan, laying siege to the primary VOC stronghold, Fort Zeelandia.
The mechanics of the siege demonstrate the limits of corporate military power. The Dutch garrison at Fort Zeelandia holds out for 9 grueling months. They are waiting desperately for a relief fleet to arrive from Batavia. When the VOC reinforcements finally arrive from Java, Koxinga's naval forces intercept and defeat them.
Without hope of resupply, the Dutch governor is forced to formally surrender the fortress and abandon the island entirely. The loss of Taiwan was not just an economic blow. It shattered the aura of VOC invincibility in East Asia and demonstrated that their corporate armies could be systematically dismantled by a sufficiently organized regional power.
The slow erosion of the 17th century accelerates into a free fall by the late 18th century. The fatal blows to the broader global network arrive in a series of catastrophic geopolitical events. First, the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War, stretching from 1781 to 1784.
This conflict was an absolute disaster for the Dutch. Their naval power was completely eclipsed by the British Royal Navy. The British systematically blockaded the Dutch coast, captured hundreds of merchant vessels, and seized vital VOC territories, particularly their remaining footholds on the Indian subcontinent.
But the geopolitical landscape of Europe is completely upended shortly after this by the advent of the Napoleonic era. The French Revolutionary armies march outward, and they occupy the Netherlands, dissolving the old Dutch Republic entirely and establishing a client state known as the Batavian Republic.
This French occupation provides the British with the perfect legal and strategic pretext to dismantle the remnants of the Dutch global network.
The British rationale is brilliantly cynical. They claim that because the Netherlands is now controlled by France, all Dutch colonial possessions are technically enemy assets that could be used by Napoleon. So the British Navy sails out and systematically seizes Dutch colonies globally under the guise of protecting them from French influence. They take the Cape Colony in Africa, they take Ceylon, modern-day Sri Lanka, and they took Malacca in Southeast Asia.
When the dust finally settles after the defeat of Napoleon, the diplomats of Europe gather to redraw the map of the world. The fate of the Dutch Empire is negotiated through the Anglo-Dutch treaties of 1814 and 1824.
And the negotiations reveal a new global hierarchy. Britain is now the undisputed hegemon. They dictate the terms. In these treaties, Britain permanently keeps some of the most strategically vital locations they had seized. They retain control of the Cape Colony, securing the route to India, and they keep Ceylon.
In Southeast Asia, the treaties formalize a strict geographic division of influence. The British take total control of the Malay Peninsula, which includes Malacca, and the rapidly rising port city of Singapore. In exchange, the Dutch are essentially permitted to consolidate their hold over the Indonesian archipelago without British interference.
This marks a fundamental shift in the mechanical nature of the Dutch presence in the world. They spent two centuries operating as a globally dispersed, highly fluid maritime network controlling specific ports, straits, and choke points across three oceans. Now they are forced to transition into managing a concentrated, territorially bound empire focused heavily on the massive landmass of Indonesia and their remaining possessions in the Caribbean.
They shifted from a monopoly of trade routes to a monopoly of territory. And though the formal political administration of this territorial empire eventually ended with a wave of decolonization in the mid-20th century, the footprints left behind by this unprecedented era of corporate and state expansion remain deeply embedded across the globe.
The cultural, physical, and linguistic imprints are not just historical artifacts, they are highly visible living elements of modern societies. We have to look at the enduring legacy.
Linguistically, the mechanics of this long-term integration are fascinating. Consider Afrikaans. It is a language derived directly from the 17th century Dutch spoken by the VOC employees and early settlers, blended with the vocabularies of the enslaved populations and indigenous groups. Today, it is spoken by millions of people as a first language across South Africa and Namibia.
And if you look at Indonesia, the dynamic is different but equally profound. The Dutch were there for over three centuries, but Dutch never became the primary spoken language of the general masses. However, the modern Indonesian language absorbed an incredible volume of Dutch vocabulary. When you look at words required for modern concepts, terms for technology, mechanical engineering, legal administration, and civil infrastructure, a massive percentage of that vocabulary is rooted entirely in Dutch loanwords.
We also see this linguistic blending in the Atlantic theater. In the Caribbean and South America, you have Creole languages like Papiamento, spoken in the ABC Islands, Aruba, Bonaire, and Curaçao. You have Stranantango, spoken in Suriname. These languages structurally reflect the deep, forced blending of Dutch administrative vocabulary with African and indigenous linguistic elements born out of the plantation economies.
The architectural legacy mirrors this blending. The physical structures left behind demonstrate how European forms were forced to adapt to entirely new environments.
In South Africa, you have the highly distinctive Cape Dutch architecture, characterizing historical towns like Stellenbosch and Swellendam, recognizable by their ornate rounded gables and whitewashed walls, originally designed to reflect the harsh sun.
In Asia, you see the development of what is called Indies architecture in major Indonesian cities like Bandung and Jakarta. The mechanics of this style are brilliant adaptations. They took heavy European neoclassical forms and altered them to survive the tropical climate. They added massive overhanging roofs to manage the monsoon rains, wide open verandas to allow for airflow, and specific cross-ventilation designs to combat the extreme heat and humidity.
Beyond the aesthetics of buildings, we must acknowledge the massive physical infrastructure engineered during the colonial era. If we look at the data for Indonesia prior to independence, the scale is staggering. We are talking about the construction of 67,000 kilometers of roads, 7,500 kilometers of railways, and modern mechanized irrigation systems covering 1.4 million hectares of agricultural land.
It is vital to understand that this infrastructure was not built as a charitable gift to the indigenous population. It was engineered specifically to extract resources, sugar, coffee, rubber, from the deep interior, and move them to the ports as quickly and cheaply as possible. It was built to maximize the efficiency of exploitation. But the historical paradox is that when the colonial era ended, that exact same infrastructure became the foundational physical matrix for the modern, independent Indonesian state.
The political process of untangling this massive imperial structure occurred primarily in the volatile decades of the mid-20th century. Following the devastation of the Second World War and the Japanese occupation of the East Indies, Indonesia officially declared its independence in August 1945.
The Dutch, severely weakened by the war in Europe, attempted to forcefully reclaim their colony, sparking a brutal four-year conflict. It was only after intense international pressure, specifically from the United States threatening to withhold Marshall Plan funds, that the Netherlands finally recognized Indonesian independence in December 1949.
The unwinding in the Atlantic theater occurred much later and under different mechanics. Suriname gained its full political independence in 1975. Meanwhile, the political structure of the Caribbean islands, such as Aruba, Curaçao, and St. Martin, evolved differently. They remain autonomous constituent countries within the modern Kingdom of the Netherlands to this day, managing their own internal affairs while relying on The Hague for defense and foreign policy.
Examining the full scope of this history forces a reflection on the deep, unavoidable complexity of global legacy. When we look at the mechanics of this empire, we are looking at a system undeniably rooted in ruthless resource extraction, the violent enforcement of coercive monopolies, and the systemic, generational use of enslaved human labor.
It was an empire built on the fundamental commodification of both land and human beings to satisfy the financial demands of European shareholders. Yet that exact same history of exploitation leaves behind shared linguistic roots that connect millions, brilliantly blended architectural styles, and deep demographic ties that continue to bind these distant regions of the globe together.
It is a reality forged by the relentless, organized pursuit of profit, executed on a global scale. Which brings us back to the premise we opened with, and leaves us with a final thought regarding the very nature of this historical entity.
We view the VOC and the WIC as historical anomalies, but they were, in fact, the genesis of the modern multinational corporation. They pioneered the legal and financial structures, joint stock ownership, limited liability, global supply chains that define our current global economy.
Exactly. When we debate the influence of massive corporations today, how they lobby governments, control our data, or manipulate global markets, the Dutch model provides the ultimate extreme historical precedent. We have to ask, what happens when a corporation becomes so structurally vital to a nation's economy that it effectively absorbs the powers of a sovereign state? And what are the inevitable human consequences when the absolute pursuit of shareholder profit is officially granted the legal mandate to wage war?
It is a crucial caution to consider.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.